Hi, everyone. I'm Shivram, and today I'm going to be talking to you about Earnest, a system that we built for efficient performance prediction of large-scale advanced analytics. This is joint work with Jong Heng and Professors Mike Franklin, Ben Recht, and Jan Stoica at the AMP Lab at Berkeley. So one of the trends that we've been observing in large-scale data analysis being run on like cloud computing infrastructure is this advent of advanced analytics workloads. So some examples of advanced analytics workloads include, for example, training machine learning models to do image classification by looking at a large number of these images. Other examples also include, for example, analyzing a lot of speech data to build these models that can be deployed on your phone in products such as like Siri or Google Now, et cetera. But this is not just restricted to the consumer space. We also find this trend in scientific applications where large-scale data processing is used to infer a number of, like, answer some new scientific problems. For example, large-scale data analysis is used for doing like solar flare detection, or some of the new gravity wave detection that was also done was by analyzing large amounts of data that was collected. So to give you an idea of how these advanced analytics workloads differ from some of the more traditional workloads that, like SQL queries that we've seen at this conference before, I'm going to walk you through one such representative example that's a part of a speech recognition pipeline using this framework called Keystone ML that we're building at Berkeley. So Keystone ML is a framework for large-scale machine learning workflows. And the way the framework works is that you express your workflow as a series of steps to be run on your input data. So for example, you might start with some raw data here. And in this pipeline, what we do is we do a cosine transformation on our raw input data first. The output of cosine transformation is then fed into, let's say, a feature normalization step. And the normalized features are then used to learn a machine learning model using, let's say, a linear solver. So this is a logical execution view of like what our machine learning workload is going to do. How does the physical view look like? So the physical view might look something like this. You have a number of machines, and your input data is like split across a large number of machines now. Each of those logical operators we had are like now translated into a number of jobs that are going to be run on the cluster. So the cosine transformation is run in parallel across all of these machines that we have. And some of the stages, for example, like the linear solver, might consist of a more complex structure of jobs that are being executed in order to just do that one functionality. So the few ways in which this differs from like more traditional workloads is that these workloads tend to be like more numerically intensive compared to like SQL queries and analytics jobs that we usually see. For example, like the cosine transformation, you might use a native library which is like well-tuned, or you might even use GPUs or some custom hardware to do it. These workloads also tend to be iterative. You might need to run a large number of iterations of the solver to get to a good model. And as you might notice, the iterations might not just consist of like one stage being repeated over and over again, but some complex portion of the DAG might be repeated a number of times as a part of this job execution. And in relation to the iterative nature of execution, most of these jobs are really long running. To train a state-of-the-art speech recognition or image classification model, it might take many days or even week on a relatively large cluster because of the size of the data and the computation that is required. So when users write these Keystone ML pipelines today, they immediately then try to deploy them on, let's say, some cloud computing infrastructure like Amazon EC2 or Microsoft Azure, et cetera. But however, when they go to deploy these applications, they're usually faced with the choice of how to construct a cluster configuration for this particular application. So right now, if you go to EC2 and you try to start a cluster, one question that you get asked is what kind of instances do you want? And there's a drop-down box with more than like 50 choices out there based on like how many SSDs you want, how much memory and CPU, et cetera. This is not just restricted to EC2. We see similar patterns in other cloud providers as well. And this is basically because there is like a matrix of choices that you can make based on the CPU, memory, and like disk requirements that you have. But note that the choices are not limited just to instance types. Cloud computing also added this dimension where you can structure your cluster exactly how you want. For example, you can choose to run one machine which is like very beefy, or you can choose a number of instances to be really large and use a large number of like small VMs. And because users have this choice, they can actually like configure the cluster for their particular workload. And this is something relatively new, which you couldn't do in the past, where typically you had a static fixed cluster that you were going to run your jobs in. But having all this choice, is it good? it's not really clear because usually users are faced with these large number of choices, and there's a lot of confusion as to how you would exactly go ahead and pick the right set of choices that you need to make for your particular workload. So looking on the other side, what are some of the user concerns? Some of the user concerns are, for example, things like, I have a 2-hour deadline. How many machines should I use so that my job finishes within 2 hours? Or some other concerns could be like, I have a $100 budget. What's the fastest way in which I can finish my job within these $100? So what we're doing in this work is we're trying to bridge this gap between what the cloud computing provider's view is and what the user's view is in how these applications are deployed. Before we did that, one of the things that we wanted to understand was how do these choices actually affect some of these advanced analytics workloads? And we did this by running a number of like small computation kernels on Amazon EC2. So the first job that we ran was this matrix multiplication workload, which is commonly found in a number of applications. And what we did here was we tried to analyze how does the choice of this instance type affect the performance of matrix multiplication. So we chose these configurations that I've listed here so that all of them have the same cost and the same amount of aggregate memory and the same number of total cores. So one R3.8 extra large machine has 16 cores, but 16 R3.large machines also have like 16 cores in the setup. So if you look at what happens when you run matrix multiplication with the setup, we find that the one big beefy machine, the R3.8 extra large, does much better than the other machines that we have under consideration here. So you might think that, oh, all right, big beefy machines are good. We sort of like knew that based on like some other ideas that we had. So are we done? So we change our workload now to do instead, let's say, QR factorization, which is another like matrix algorithm used in a number of like workloads. And what we find there is that the pattern is sort of reversed. In this case, the 16 small VMs actually do much better than this one big machine that we have. So the underlying reason is that one of these workloads is more network bound, and having one machine means that you have no network traffic that you have to account for, and so the one machine works very well. On the other hand, the QR factorization workload is more memory bandwidth bound, and it turns out that using 16 small VMs gives you a lot more memory bandwidth than one machine, which is limited to 60 gigabytes per second. So this was on the instance type side. We also did some benchmarks to see how does scaling change as we increase the number of instances that we deploy. So for the same QR factorization workload from the previous slide, we increased the number of cores that we had in the cluster from 2 cores to around 512 cores and measured its performance. So the ideal strong scaling curve looks something like this. Every time you double the number of cores, the running time goes to half or halves. But what we actually found in our measurements was very different from the ideal running time. And what we saw was that while the computation scales up to some number of machines or some number of cores, for example, to up to 64 cores, as you go from 64 to 128 to 256, the scaling pattern, it sort of hits a bottleneck and the performance like flattens out. So this is primarily because every computation, every parallel job has some computation and some communication. And if you increase the number of machines that you're using, then the communication costs are going to start dominating at some point. So in some sense, there's this nonlinear scaling that is inherent in all the parallel computation that we do, and it's very hard for the users to find out where is this optimal point at which scaling is not going to be beneficial for me at all. So in this work, we try to address these problems, and the way we go about addressing these problems is that we try to build a high-level performance model for like an advanced analytics job that you're going to run. There are quite a few challenges in trying to build this kind of performance model. So one of the questions is, what do we know about these jobs? Or what can we assume that we know about these jobs? So we try to minimize the amount of knowledge that we need to have about these jobs by trying to build a black box model where we don't look inside the job to figure out the DAG structure or something like that, but instead use high-level patterns that are most frequently occurring. But one of the downsides of that is that we might need to actually run the job a few times to figure out the performance model before we can execute the full job. And thus, there's a model building overhead, or the amount of time that we spend in building a model that we need to account for. So our key insight in this work is that these workloads exhibit some structure that we can actually exploit to make this model building overhead very cheap. So in the next part of the talk, I'm going to discuss what this structure is and how we can exploit it. So to model these advanced analytics workloads, we consider them in two separate parts. One is related to computation, and the second related to communication. So for computation scaling patterns, we observe two main trends. The first trend we observe is that as we increase the amount of input, the running time increases proportionally to that input if your computation is linear in terms of the amount of input. So for example, here we went from 2 blocks of input to 4 blocks of input. Using the same number of machines, it takes double the amount of time. On the other hand, if you increase the number of machines, we find that the computation time usually scales inversely to the number of machines that we have in our cluster. So for the same 4 blocks of data, if we go to 4 machines now, our computation time halves as it were compared to what it was before. Note that this is just the computation time. There is some additional overhead that we need to pay for having four extra machines, and we'll cover that in terms of the communication patterns that we observe. So speaking of communication patterns, we see that there are a small number of communication patterns that repeatedly occur in these jobs, and that if we can capture these communication patterns, we can actually model the jobs pretty well. So this has actually been studied in other papers that have been presented here at NSDI as well, in terms of like the CoFlow model, where we have a small number of patterns that repeatedly occur in these big data jobs. So one of the models that we see is this one-to-one communication pattern, which as you add more machines, the communication costs stay constant because it's a one-to-one mapping. On the other hand, other patterns that are commonly used in aggregation is this like tree aggregation pattern, where the communication cost grows as log as the input number of machines that we have. And finally, there's the linear pattern or the all-to-one pattern, where the communication grows linearly with respect to the number of machines we have in our cluster. So putting it together, we can form a high-level model for the total running time as a sum of a number of terms that we have and a variable amount that each of these terms contribute to the total running time. Or in other words, our total running time is composed of some serial execution time, x1, some linear computation time multiplied by another coefficient, x2, and some of the terms of communication multiplied by coefficients x3 and x4. So this is like a linear model that we have built with these unknowns x1, x2, x3, x4, and where we have these variables, input, and number of machines. So our high-level workflow here is that we'll collect some training data, and we can then use linear regression to actually find the values for x1, x2, x3, x4, and we can get a model for this job. Note that this is a high-level basic model, and in the paper we discuss some extension to this model as well. So all of these model-building systems which use such regression models often have this question of how much training data do we need, or how expensive is it to collect training data? So a straw man is to just collect training data across all of the points in a grid, which is, as you can see, very expensive to do. So this is slightly better baseline, where we can say each experiment costs some amount of money, and then we can try to pick the cheapest experiments using sort of a greedy algorithm approach. But we found that both of these approaches don't work very well in practice because they don't capture what the model is trying to learn. So the idea of like which training data points are most useful is actually very well studied in the field of statistics in an area called optimal design of experiments. So optimal experiment design applies for linear models, which is expressed as a sum of a number of terms. And what it does is that you can set up an optimization problem where you try to minimize the variance of the model subject to some constraints. So in this case, we place a constraint on the total time we want to spend collecting training data. And then we can form this optimization problem to tell us which are the most important points that we need to consider. So our workflow looks something like we form this grid, and we plug in that optimization problem to a solver, which then returns the most important points for our particular problem where we need to collect training data, given the budget we have at hand. So end-to-end, the workflow of using Earnest looks something like this. The user submits a job binary and some constraints on the machine and the input size to Earnest. And Earnest is composed of a number of Python modules which execute one after another. The first module is experiment design, which figures out the training data points to use. And then we run these training jobs based on the user's given job binary, and we run a few iterations of the job in order to understand its performance pattern. Having collected these job run times, we then build a linear model which can be used to do things like analyze how the time varies as we increase the number of machines for this job, et cetera. There are more details in the paper on how we detect when the model is wrong and how we can extend this model, and also some of the system concerns around straggler mitigation and performance variations over time. And I'd encourage you to read the paper for that. In terms of evaluation, to evaluate Earnest, we asked ourselves a number of objectives, and we measured those objectives on a number of workloads consisting of machine learning and scientific algorithms run on Amazon EC2. In this talk, I'm going to focus on the Keystone ML pipeline that I introduced early on and work through how we can check the optimal number of machines on the prediction accuracy and training overhead for those. So the model that we learned for the Keystone ML pipeline that I introduced early on looks something like this for running like 100 iterations of this pipeline on R3.extra-large machines. On the x-axis here, I have the number of machines, and on the y-axis, the total time taken. And as you can see, this workload has a bottleneck at around 25 machines or so, and in fact, the performance becomes worse after around 40 machines, and it starts going up again. One way to use this model is to say that, let's say I have a 2-hour deadline, then you can know that using 20 machines is actually more optimal than using 100 machines, as you're going to pay like 5x lesser amount of money to get the same amount of performance for this workload. We also measured how accurate Earnest is by measuring the actual time taken on a number of these points. And this is the time for one iteration now on the y-axis. What we see is that there's a 10 to 15% prediction error across a number of these workloads. And we believe that this error margin is good enough for making coarse-grained predictions on the number of instances and instance types, which is our application here. In terms of training time, the model that I showed in the previous slide, it was trained using 7 data points suggested using experiment design, and we used up to 16 machines and 10% of data to do the actual training. The overall training time was around 6 minutes, which compared to the optimal running time of the algorithm, which is around 1.5 hours or so, is a very small percentage, less than 7% of the optimal running time. And this shows that even spending a few minutes trying to learn this performance model can actually give you significant benefits when you're running this long-running job. Finally, we also verified if experiment design was useful by comparing it to the greedy scheme that I showed earlier in the talk. And we see that for a number of applications, the greedy scheme has very high prediction error, while experiment design has prediction error below 20% for all of them. So in conclusion, what we saw today is that there's this trend of running advanced analytics computations in cloud computing scenarios, and this leads to some new challenges with respect to computation and communication patterns that affect scalability. To handle these, we proposed a performance prediction framework with low overhead that uses an end-to-end linear model and optimal experiment design in order to be efficient. With that, I'll take any questions. Thank you.
Hi there, Luis Pedrosa, USC. So this is very interesting work, and thank you for presenting it like this. I have a question about what happens when you train the model at a different scale than when you actually want to use it, which in some cases I can imagine would be a common case. You can train it in house with like your small cluster at home, mm-hmm. but then your startup is taking off. You want mm-hmm. to rent a few thousand machines or a few million machines or something, and you want to see
right.
how that would work.
Right.
Can your bottleneck shift in a way that the model does not handle it?
Right.
And how big of a problem can that be?
Right. So the model assumes that the machines that you're using and some characteristics of the workload, like the communication, computation, like let's say if you're going to transfer more data, if you have more machines, then the model is not going to be applicable for the really large cluster that you have. So one goal that we had in this work was to make the model training really cheap, that if you're going to a new cluster with, let's say, 1,000 machines, then you can retrain your model within a few minutes or so, and that you don't need to reuse a stale model. The other thing is we discussed some techniques in order to like detect if the model is wrong by doing cross-validation. So you can run a similar like training period on the new cluster and then cross-validate whether the old model is actually working for the new cluster as well. And if it's wrong, then you can detect using that and figure out if you should train a new model or not. Yeah.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, go ahead.
Mohammed from Microsoft. Actually, I had the same exact question, but I will follow up. So how do you detect that your model is now like way off than the ground truth optimal, which includes like checking all of the dimensions and all of the different configurations.
Right, so the way we detect whether the model is correct or wrong is, so you would need to run, so let's say you have a brand new cluster or some brand new data set, and you want to figure out if the model is still applicable. You would need to run the training jobs on the new data set. You don't need to run all of them, but let's say you run like two or three data points, right? Then you try to predict the time taken for these training jobs using the old model that you have. So you compute, for example, training error in some sense. Training error usually correlates well to like test error in machine learning settings. If your model is accurate, if you're getting a low train error, then you have a good idea you're going to get some low test error.
I see. So he mentioned something actually I wanted to ask. Also, as the workload changes,
right.
so for example, the application may be bandwidth intensive, then
right.
it becomes like memory intensive.
Right.
So it's, it changes. So
right.
like if you have different workloads,
right.
like much bigger than... Like,
right. So we actually train a different model for each of those workloads that I showed out there. Because the model is workload specific in some sense. So... again, that was part of our goal, was to make the model training really cheap, that if you change, like, let's say even a line of code in your workload, then you should be able to retrain the model very fast,
okay.
Rather than using the older model.
Yeah, okay. But I have another question.
We can do that.
Yeah. Off.
Is yours yeah. quick? We have like 10 seconds. You can do a quick
sure,
question, maybe.
Okay, very quickly. Okay. Günser, Cornell University. So when we were working on the Troika system for doing performance prediction for MapReduce type workloads, mm-hmm. One of the things we noticed is that baking in any kind of an assumption about the topology, the amount of communication, et cetera, mm-hmm. was actually kind of tough. Mm-hmm. That's why the response surfaces are actually, I think, a good idea, because they don't actually assume all that much about the underlying patterns. Mm-hmm. So in your experience, mm-hmm. what you've baked in a fairly fixed model. Under what circumstances do you expect it to be violated?
So we have baked in some assumptions about the workloads in our model. I think, so we've mostly targeted sort of these like machine learning workloads that are in some sense, if you give a small amount of data and large amount of data, the communication computation patterns are repeatable. Because let's say you're running gradient descent, if you have a small amount of data, you do a gradient on all the data points you have. More data points, you do a gradient on all of the new data points that you have. It'll break if there are patterns that are not repeatable on small sparse fractions of the data. So if you have a very selective join, for example, on a small sample of data, your join might produce no keys. If you have really large amount of data, suddenly your join might have a very hot key that you did not see in small amount of data. So we believe in applications which have this pattern of like this reproducing the same pattern in small fractions of the data, this sort of approach will work very well. Yeah.
Okay, thanks to the speaker again. Mm-hmm.